and welcome to another episode of Tell Them Who You Are. My name is Brandon Farmahini, and I am joined by Christina Sinsoon Ramirez, Austin area activist, author, and founder of Jolt and the Workers Defense Project. Christina, how are you doing this lovely day today?
I'm good. It's, you know, 60-something degrees outside and sunny, and I'm not sick or unemployed. So given the global circumstances, I'm doing quite well.
What's up with that? It was freezing 2 days ago.
I know. I lost like half of my garden because we didn't really pay attention to the weather drop. So it was about, you know, the lost half of it, but it's okay.
Yeah. I got one of those when I first like got a house and we got a garden, I bought like, you know, the plant warmer things and they're in my garage. And then I heard about the freeze and I was like, I don't care.
I'm more low key, more low tech, like sheets, you know, that's about it.
Whatever works. So Christina, I am super excited to have you. I think most people familiar with you probably know you from your run for U.S. Senator in the great state of Texas. Overall, how was that experience for you?
You know, it took like a year of my life away from my child to have a 3-year-old little boy. I feel like running in a state of 29 million people and as expansive as the state was challenging, but also really fun. And I think what I learned is just that the Democratic Party is at this tipping point, mm-hmm. both within Texas and the country, and that the progressive insurgency, which I include myself part of,
sure.
has done a good job winning at state houses, local races, congressional races, but no progressive has won statewide in all of the races that we've tried. And that's just because we've got to build some more infrastructure. But it takes good people running and losing before good people can run and win.
Oh, that makes complete sense. And I notice you're using the term progressive. Do you think that's a better strategy than the other term that you hear thrown around a lot is socialist? Do you think that using the words that we choose to describe our platforms and the weight that they carry matter?
Yeah, I think that, like, you know, I've been an organizer in Texas for almost 20 years. And I really think that the person that I'm always trying to move, why I actually love doing this kind of work in Texas, is that there is generally no lefty choir to preach to. There are only non-believers to convert. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, I think the things that I stand for as a progressive, believing that government can be a force for good in our lives, believing that healthcare should be a right for every single person in the richest country in the world, that education should be free for every single person because it's an investment into our people, including college, not just K through 12, but college, believing that we can actually have a green economy instead of one that just pollutes our communities and harms our health, that we are told that those are radical propositions, but they are not. Every other industrialized nation on the planet does these things for its people. We just haven't had the political will to do it. And that's both because of Republicans that are beholden to big billionaires and their donors, mm-hmm. and Democrats that are also sometimes beholden to those donors, and a political system that has made them feel like they have to compromise the needs of all of us. So yes, I'm a progressive, but to me, a progressive means just at the end of the day that you are trying to act in the best interest of the American people and understanding that it's our government, it's our job to make it work for us. And right now it's mostly been working for a few very wealthy individuals.
Sure, sure.
And corporations.
Sure. No, that makes complete sense. So let's back up a little bit, try to understand where you're coming from. So as I understand it, you're kind of a child of two cultures.
Yeah, you know, I grew up, my mom's from Mexico. She's the oldest of 9 kids from a really poor farmworking family in the state of Michoacan, Mexico. And then my dad's this white American hippie. He met my mom. He went to UT Austin for a couple years. He didn't graduate, but he went there. And him and a bunch of folks went to Mexico in the 70s and were living there, traveling there. And that's when he met my mom. And my mom is not a hippie at all. She's like a campesina, you know, farm working, very humble background. And so I feel like I grew up in between the perfect trifecta, which is Mexico, Texas, and actually Ohio.
Yeah.
That's where I graduated high school. So
I can relate a little bit. My mother was Cajun from Southern Louisiana, my father, Iran. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, did you feel a similar kind of conflict at times with two kind of warring competing cultures, or did you feel like you were able to kind of fuse the best of everything together?
Yeah, I think for like most halfies, we always feel like we live in between two worlds. And right. I think for me, one, I grew up in a community, so we lived in Texas when I was really young. And then we went back to Ohio and I lived in a community that was 96% white. Like that's the last census. And, we would always go back to Mexico, like every single year, multiple times a year. So, my parents raised me to actually believe that I was more special than other people because I was half Mexican. So I grew up with like this chip on my shoulder. And it wasn't until middle school that I was like, oh, people discriminate against Mexicans. They don't necessarily think I'm cooler. And it was like this big culture shock for me. But
you knew you were Mexican though, right?
No, I always thought like I'm Mexican and this makes me so awesome because I speak two languages and the rest of my friends, they don't speak two languages.
I thought I was white.
We knew like we were Mexican, like through and through we were Mexican.
I had experience similar in middle school where you had to put, it was like probably geography class or a history class. One of those teachers was like, if your parents were born in a country that wasn't the United States, write it on the board.
Uh-huh.
So you saw Canada, you saw UK, because I grew up, I don't know if you're familiar with Houston at all, but in Katy. So it was very Caucasian. And then, you know, I wrote Iran. And when I say like I thought I was white, I knew my father was Iranian.
Yeah,
you know, I had been in Iran at the time. But there's just, you know, in terms of your own identity, you don't understand how different you are until you see how uncomfortable you can make other people when they confront it. And this is pre-9/11. So I'll always remember to the day I die, the reaction, like the facial reactions of classmates and, you know, people I grew up with. I don't know if I'd call it fear or anxiety, but like that was a turning point where I felt like an other.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a similar experience growing up in a predominantly Caucasian background, or as you were saying, you're always very aware of your own identity?
I was always very aware because my parents made us very aware that we were Mexican, but like with a real, real sense of pride in who we were. Like they told us that it was special and this incredible gift, like that we could speak two languages, that we could go places that other kids didn't know, that they didn't even know about Mexico and how cool it was when we knew about it. So I thought it was really cool. And it wasn't till middle school. And so that was like in the early 90s, mid 90s. And that I started to have people be mean to me or say racist things. I remember like my mom's dark skinned and my dad's light skin. My dad's white, obviously. And we all turned out pretty light skinned. So we could pass. Like if we were with my mom, they knew we were her children. If we were with my dad, they would assume we were white. So that's when I started to see, because if I would show up at a place with my dad versus my mom, it was like, oh, well, people are treating us really differently than we're just with my mom. And I remember particularly I had a middle school teacher, Mr. Richards, who I vehemently still dislike to this day, who was clearly very racist. And he, for example, when he found out my mom was Mexican, and my mom speaks English,
right?
But even if she didn't, she would still have the right to do this, is she signed a permission slip and he wouldn't accept it for something. I don't remember what it was for. He said my dad had to write a letter giving my mother permission if she was going to sign anything because she didn't understand English well enough to sign.
Did you go to school in the 1880s?
Right. Yeah. I think it was like 1994 probably. Yeah. I think that's what I remember. But I do also remember moving to Texas. I moved here when I was 21 and really worrying that the other like Chicanos, Mexican Americans might not think I was Mexican enough. And then I got here and I realized a lot of folks thought I was very Mexican because I spoke Spanish really well and I knew a lot about Mexico. And I also realized like there's things about me that some people might want to say are white, but they're just part of who I am. And I prefer ranchero music. I prefer punk rock music. I've been vegan for some 20 something years. And so people might want to say those are.
What kind of tortillas do you like?
Well, my family's from Southern Mexico, so we only eat corn. Okay. We don't understand the whole wheat thing. That's like a whole nother or flour, wheat tortilla. That's not what we do.
Yeah. My wife's from Monterrey, Mexico. So North Mexico, but she's still hardcore corn tortillas as well.
Wow.
But I'm a flour tortilla lad through and through.
Well, I guess if you Houston grew up boy. In Texas, yes. Yeah, that makes sense. So
yeah, Tex-Mex food, which, oh man, don't bring up Tex-Mex around my wife. There's nothing that will make her angrier.
There's some snobbery. It's true. It exists.
Tex-Mex is superior. I'm sorry.
Oh, I think that snobbery, as I mentioned, Mexicans think that their food is better.
Yeah, I agree that it, but it's the opposite. Tex-Mex is totally better.
I guess if you grew up around it, I can see how you would think that.
Very diplomatic answer. Very
yeah.
Diplomatic answer. So you arrived in Austin. You went to the University of Texas.
I went to ACC first. I went to Austin Community College first.
Oh, okay. And then you transferred into the Latin American Studies program.
Yeah, so I actually moved here when I was 21, and I didn't know. So in high school, I hated high school. My parents told me that I would love Austin because they said it had everything I liked. It was kind of a hippie town that had really good vegetarian food and a lot of Mexicans. So I thought, that's the town for me, and it's sunny all year round. And so I would obsessively look up the weather in Austin when I was in high school. And then I moved here when I was 21. I packed a suitcase. I didn't know anyone in the city. And I just took a flight down here, and I stayed at the youth hostel here in Austin for like 3 weeks or a month. And I cleaned and stayed there until I could find a job and a place to live. And that's how I ended up in Austin.
So did that experience staying at the hostel, what experience kind of led to your involvement and activism outside of academics in the city of Austin?
Well, I moved down here also with that intention. Like, I would read a lot of history. You know, I did two kinds of sets of work. I was in my late teens, and when I was 20, I was doing a lot of what I would say like activist work, which is in trying to change systems and structures that asked the big questions about, like, why does our economy work the way it does? Why does our criminal justice system work the way it does? And then on the side, and that was mostly with like really great folks, but folks that were pretty disconnected from the directly impacted situations we were trying to change. And on the other side, because I was bilingual, when I was growing up, there were very, very few Latinos in Columbus, Ohio. But when I turned about like 16, people started to arrive from southern Mexico, from the state of Oaxaca, mostly people that were indigenous. So their first language was not Spanish. Their first language was mostly Zapotec. But I would translate for them and help them get into schools. And I was doing all this social service work. And I really liked doing it, but it also felt like I was helping one person at a time on one side with people that were directly impacted. And on the other side, I was working with folks that had really good intentions, were asking the right questions, but weren't working with folks that were directly impacted. And so I decided I would move to Texas because I had read so much about the history of social movements in the Latino community here in Texas. And I didn't know what organizations existed, but I figured I would find some and get involved. And so that's also why I moved here. And that's how I found the first like legal project I worked on, which was helping immigrant workers that weren't paid or injured on the job. And that's how I started doing work here in Austin.
So I think I'm familiar with the Better Builder program in that I'm a nerd. So as a hobby, I follow city politics.
I couldn't tell.
And I seem to remember that coming into play with the, I don't know if you're familiar with the Plaza Saltillo development at the old train yards. So can you describe what the program does for workers? As I understood it then, and I could be wrong, one of the big things is, you know, is pay, like fair pay and hours. But could you describe, I guess, what it does for the people who are building our infrastructure?
Yeah. So I guess if I could just go back first to like why we decided to do that in the first place. So like we were helping people that weren't paid on they were paid like below minimum wage. They weren't paid overtime. And most frequently they would go to work for someone. And like at the end of the week, the person would fire them instead of paying them and turn around and say, you're undocumented. I don't have to pay you. And so we set up clinics to help them. But most of the workers, I would say 80, 85%, all worked in construction. And so it seemed really systemic in the industry. And as we dug in deeper, we found out that in Texas, the largest employer of undocumented labor is the construction industry, that half of the people building our schools, our homes, these mega fancy hotels and buildings in every downtown city in the state, that half of those workers are undocumented, that they were facing terrible conditions, not just on pay, but that every 2.5 days, a construction worker was being killed on the job here in Texas. It was totally underreported, if reported at all. And so we really tried to shine a light on that and change it at a policy level, but also at an industry level. And so we realized that who had the real power were these very well-to-do developers, mm-hmm. because small contractors weren't a big enough fish in the pond really to change how the currents of the system worked. And right, so we needed to do that from top to top and then translate it to the bottom. So we got developers to sign legally binding agreements with us. When I was there, we started that in like the last 2 years I was at Workers Defense Project. And in those 2 years, we got $500 million worth of agreements.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah. So it covered thousands and thousands of workers. And it had just like some basic guidelines about how to raise wages, make jobs safer, make sure that there was a minimum like living wage, and also protect the good union jobs that existed in the industry. It was about like raising the floor. And the city of Austin ended up adopting a lot of those standards for any time. That was the other thing, is that big corporations were coming into Austin and getting millions and millions of dollars in tax breaks with no questions asked about how the people that were going to build those facilities would be treated.
Sure.
And so we got the city of Austin to start asking and demanding higher wages and conditions for all of those workers.
That's awesome. So I think like most, I mean, everyone should agree that all of these are great things. The practical side, looking at it, you know, the infrastructure in this country historically has been built on exploited labor. I mean, we're not even talking just about slaves, but clearly slaves, but even post-slavery period, whether it was Irish immigrants, Chinese immigrants, or just poor people who were worked way too much, children who were overworked. Mm-hmm. So we've entered a new phase of, you know, being able to pay people properly, make sure the proper safety mechanisms are there, but our infrastructure is crumbling and we're facing staggering costs for projects, any kind of project. So how do we reconcile the dire need for better infrastructure, more projects, and the high cost of non-exploited labor?
I don't feel that there's tension with the reality of the cost. That if you look at when our country had the strongest middle class, right? Like, it isn't like the country was perfect in the 1950s. Just ask like Black folks that was going for them. But as far as wage and wealth distribution, it was at its strongest when labor was at its strongest.
And right, but to be fair, half the world was destroyed in the 50s.
Yeah, but we also invested, right? We put the resources of government into creating the infrastructure we needed.
Like the Eisenhower Highway Funds
if you look at an issue like climate change, and this is what so many folks are talking about, right?
A lot of the LBJ stuff.
Yeah, that if you look at, like, we built a highway system, we built so much infrastructure in this country, and we created in the process millions of good jobs, and that only made our economy flourish more. And we're in that same moment where we have all of these infrastructure needs. We have tens of millions of people right now that are out of work. Work will likely be changed even after COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And so what better way, historically, economically speaking, than to invest the money that government has that it often gives away? Think about all the money we gave away in the CARES Act that went to big corporations, right? Like Trump himself got millions of dollars that they didn't need. What if instead we put that to putting people actually back to work and invested also in small businesses and businesses that were predominantly excluded in times in our country when we've actually invested money and then didn't allow it to go to communities of color?
Well, how do you explain to people this? Because like one issue that locally, and I think a lot of people can relate, is convention center business, right? I'm a big advocate of expanding the convention center. I don't know if you read the UT report on the proposal and all the advantages. And
I am not as big a nerd as you, apparently.
Okay, well, the point is, what we're hearing is people are like, oh, well, it's a recession with the COVID, we can't be spending this money, but the Hoover Dam was built in the Depression. How do you educate people without sending them back to school to learn the things they apparently didn't learn, that like we need to be spending money. We need the government to be doing more infrastructure projects in order to get us out of a recession, or at least to employ people during a recession. How do we deal with the staggering, seemingly amount of uneducated folk in this country? Because it feels like that's a core of the problem we're dealing with, is that we can't even have conversations because we don't even agree on the same facts or the same history.
I do think that what we agree on is the economic pain that our country is in, right? Like, whether you're like, there are people that voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary that went and voted for Trump, and there are
right
thousands and thousands of them. And they did that because they are in deep economic pain. People cannot afford their rents or mortgages. How many people in our generation are absolutely fucking drowning in student debt?
Right.
They have mortgages on their mind they're going to be paying for 30 years. And in the meantime, they get to live in their parents' basements instead of being able to have a mortgage for a home. People that have no way to afford healthcare, and then don't even talk about retirement. Like, an entire generation of people have no way to, like, they're going to be working to the grave. And quite literally,
yeah,
that is the economic system we built in this country. So I think people agree on that. So we've tried the way of, like, let's give, the data is very clear, like, giving corporate tax giveaways does not create jobs, because those corporations and those individuals that are making that money keep that money for themselves. Yeah. They don't reinvest it back into their companies.
Like, we need a trickle up economy. I mean, gravity be damned, right?
Yeah.
I understand it doesn't.
Let's just say, if all we judge our economy by is not by GDP or how well big corporations are doing, can we just judge it by how well ordinary people are doing? So how much savings do most Americans have? What is their ability to buy a home? And when is their ability to retire? If those were the three factors we judged our economy on, then that would change everything. So if you do that, then you have to say, yeah, we actually have to tax big corporations their mm-hmm. fair share. Any society that's going to function is not going to allow the Jeff Bezos of the world to wreak billions and billions of dollars while so many people are out of work and pay $0 in corporate taxes. No society that functions can do that. And I actually think most people agree on that. What people are told and is a lie is that if we invest money into these programs, that it will not serve the interests of all of us. And that is where the lie is. Or they tell us that mm-hmm. there's not enough money for it. When there is enough money, it just means that the super ultra rich have to cough up sure. their fair share, and they haven't been.
Do you think a core of the problem is the Reagan era? What was the saying? Government isn't the fix to the problem. Government is the problem. It's mm-hmm. it's like almost the exact opposite of what JFK said. It's not what your country can do for you. You can do for your country. We look at a place like Germany, for instance, and their faith and their government is staggering. And
it's 17%. With 17% right now of Americans trust our government.
Is that a core problem with the government's ability to accomplish anything that we wanted to accomplish?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in 1964, 77% of them, I just actually was writing about this, is why I know the numbers off the top.
Yeah. I was man, she's
good.
Prepared.
Yeah, we did not prepare these questions. But no, in 1964, 77%.
Sorry, it's not my style.
Right. Like, this isn't, think about it, this isn't like the middle of the civil rights movement.
Right.
1964, 77% of Americans say, I trust my government. Mm-hmm. Today, it's 17%, 1-7. And so if people don't trust their government, then that means that, in essence, we don't trust ourselves, because government should really be an extension of ourselves.
Sure.
But we have to remember that we got to this place, not just by happenstance, but we got here because the Koch brothers, over the last mm-hmm. 30 plus years, and their other billionaire class friends have spent
brother,
hundreds of millions of dollars to try and reshape Americans' thinking about government. There's
right.
a great book I highly recommend, which is by Jane Mayer. It's called Dark Money. It's about how we changed our perspective on democracy and how the ultra right wing took over our government. Mm-hmm. But who is also to blame are actually Democrats. Because if you look, go back to Reagan, and when Reagan did his tax cuts, instead of Democrats fighting and saying, you know, having a tax base so that we can pay for the basic things that every person deserves, and we should actually make sure that we expand public benefits for the American people, because most mm-hmm. people actually want expansion of public mm-hmm. benefits. Democrats said, okay, the right wing won the narrative. We didn't even fight back. And most Democrats signed on to the biggest tax cut in the 1980s. That is how we got to this place that we're in now. And it wasn't until Trump's recent attempt and successful attempt to restructure our taxes again, even more in benefit for the ultra wealthy, that Democrats have started to stand up.
We're talking about a lot is, I don't know if you want to call it theoretical, less practical approaches. One way Congress used to be able to reach bipartisan compromises was through earmarks. So that's how we funded infrastructure in this country for a long time. That's also how we are able to get, you know, bipartisanship, because we can actually bring people in when they can't compromise on principles. We can still give them something to make their constituents happy. And we're facing crumbling infrastructure across this country that's now falling on local taxpayers. So with Congress not doing these earmarked infrastructure deals anymore, because I think the fallout from the Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska, is that a reason why we're not seeing as much infrastructure investments? And should we bring that back as a way to revitalize bipartisanship agreements?
I mean, I think that we are at a crisis, an incredibly divided country for multiple reasons. Part of that has to do with race and demographics. Part of that has to do with not reconciling our founding of this country and its impact on folks that are descendants of slaves and indigenous communities whose land was taken to create this country. I think as progressives, sometimes we think about, in this country, we have not been trained to think structurally. We've often been trained to think about pieces. I think it's pretty hard to fix our government. I get what you're saying, but I think there's three things that we have to do as progressives to rebuild our economy and democracy actually to be in the benefit of all of us, because we've also seen an absolute erosion of what used to be common values around democracy. Like, we have sitting senators right now questioning whether we should be a democracy or not. Like, that is a real, real shift, a paradigm shift. But I think the three things is, one, we're not going to fix our democracy until we get money out of politics. Like, the amount of dark money, big corporate money, big donor money that can influence elections is obscene. We have to come to a place as a country where we have publicly financed elections, because it shouldn't be about how many rich people you know. It needs to be about who has the best ideas.
If you're talking about taking on Citizens United, those are amendments. Those are constitutional amendments. And, you know, one of the first things that our founders did after they all agreed on the Constitution was change it. We often act like the Bill of Rights was as a part of Constitution when it wasn't. It was the first 10 things we want to change. And yet I feel like, I could be wrong, but I think we're at a record number of years where we haven't had a constitutional amendment. And I don't see any other way to fix what you're describing, right? Like, you can't overrule the Supreme Court. So are you in favor of constitutional amendments as it relates to money and politics and other issues as well?
Well, I think that there's also, I think what you need to have legislative and judicial strategies. Like, this is where the right has really failed. And this is something, where the left has failed, but the right has done really well, is we have not had judicial strategies long-term, like Supreme Court cases setting precedent to then overturn and change the reality, whether it's on a multitude of issues. That is something that the right wing has mapped out and done for decades, understanding what that does. Right now, we have a pretty unfavorable Supreme Court. I've thought long and hard about whether we expand the Supreme Court. And at this stage, I believe we need to expand the Supreme Court and have judicial strategies that will set new precedent for the Supreme Court. As far as constitutional amendments go, you're right. Our Constitution was a framework. There are so many great things in our Constitution, things that I feel like were such radical things that they put in the Constitution at its time that are still radical today. The freedom of speech, right? Mm-hmm. The right to assembly. Like, these were radical ideas that people could create, that we would create a democracy where there weren't going to be kings, but people that were elected. But then we said, oh, not everyone's vote is equal, and we only have 3/5 of human beings. Like, that sits within our Constitution. So we need to, I think that we need to understand that there are frameworks and works in progress, but if the value should be that we are always striving and working towards achieving real democracy. And real democracy means that, one, you don't get outsized influence because you have more money. And two, we should make it as easy as possible for every single person to vote in this country, that it should be a right you are born with and that you die with. That very idea that we even, if we start with that value and framework, we wouldn't get to a place where we're also disenfranchising millions of people that have felony convictions.
Do you think there's an opportunity after this last election for Democrats? Because before, the conversation on the right as it related to voter ID was, well, we have to make sure we're talking about citizens. And it's, hey, you know, it's hard to argue against that. You know, it's hard to argue we shouldn't be concerned about people who aren't citizens of the country voting. However, with this election, it feels like the focus isn't on non-citizens voting. It's whether or not legal citizens were participating in the right arbitrary red tape rules for their vote to count, which is a much, I would think, harder opinion or harder stance to have than just saying, well, officially, I just want citizens to vote. So is there an opportunity to seize on this seemingly undemocratic stance?
Look, I didn't vote for Biden in the primary, but I'm like so excited that we beat Trump.
Right.
Because democracy, it isn't that like him getting elected fixes everything. It means that not everything collapses, including democracy, because we were about to see like democracy in itself collapse. And now we get a chance to try and rebuild it.
We'd have been an autocracy. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I do not think that the voter ID laws were ever right. That was just.
I agree. I know what you're saying. That wasn't their intent. That's what they said.
Right.
That's what they were saying. But that's not what they're saying now.
Right. They're not even pretending.
They're not pretending anymore.
Yeah. And that's why I think we have to be guided by the value set of like, our job is to expand democracy always. And that should be the value set we work towards. So like what Democrats did, which they hadn't done in a long time, they introduced H.R. 1 last.
It was the first thing they did when in 2019 when they took office.
Yeah. And it was a voting rights bill, right? Mm-hmm. That was really expanding people's right to vote and protecting it. I'll tell you what, when I ran for Senate, I got people that were much more moderate than me.
when I ran for Senate, you throw that in there in conversation with people. You know, when I was running for Senate,
I don't know that it's like you can just put your name on the list. It was a 12-way dogfight, to be clear. And this 12-way dogfight I was part of, when I ran for Senate, the thing that was most popular that I would talk about, they would be like, what do you want to do when you get to Senate? I would say, well, you know, I believe we face many crises, climate change, income inequality. But the number one thing we need to do is fix our democracy. And we have to do three things. We have to get money out of politics. We have to make sure that we're making it as easy as possible for every single person to vote in this country. You shouldn't even have to register to vote. You should be able to opt in. It should be an opt-out system instead of an opt-in system.
Exactly.
And then we should make Election Day a national federal holiday. I mean, like people were like, get up and applaud like it was the most amazing thing they'd ever heard. But these are the most basic things that Democrats should be fighting for. Some were, but many were not.
So let's talk about your senatorial campaign. At what point did you decide to run for the Senate? I mean, against a very popular incumbent. What made you want to take on such a challenge? Because for those who aren't familiar, Ted Cruz is not popular in his own family. He's not popular in Texas.
Well, John Boehner, what are the two quotes John Boehner said? He's a son of a bitch, and that's the nicest thing I have to say about him.
Yeah. So Beto running against Ted Cruz is a lot different than anybody running against John Cornyn, who's much more established. He's been in Texas politics much longer.
He's not as vehemently disliked by
both
sides.
Not at all. Not at all. I think most people can't even tell you much about him, which means they probably don't have too much negative to say. So it was quite a challenge to do that. So what made you decide that you were going to take on that challenge?
So One, I have lived for changing the politics of Texas. My last organization I founded after the week of the 2016 election was to mobilize young Latino voters, with the understanding that, especially if you look at the demographics and numbers of the state, that young Latinos have really the power to unlock and shift the political outcome of the state. And that if you change Texas, you change the entire country. And you can change it on every single issue we care about, every single issue we've mentioned. Money in politics, climate change, immigration, income inequality. So many of these issues come home here to Texas. So back in the spring of 2019, I was approached and asked by some other folks that have done progressive politics in Texas. They called me up. They said, "We have a wild idea for you. We want you to run for Senate and we'll all help you." And I was like, "No, why'd you really call?" And I was just like, why'd you really call? And they're like, no, we really think you would be great. Like, we'll help you do it. This, like, now is the moment in time for someone like you to run. And will you do it? It was a Friday. And they said, "We'll call us back on Monday and let us know what you think. Like, spend the weekend thinking about it." And I really didn't spend the weekend thinking about it. I was like, okay. And so they called me on Monday and then they kept calling. And I spent some time thinking about it. And I mean, at first it felt like a pretty wild thing to do, to be honest. It was not on my bucket list of like, this was my plan of what I was going to do. But I've always tried to make progressive change, thinking about like, what is the greatest realm of impact that I, Christina, can have in this moment? So when I was 24, it was like organizing undocumented workers to try and change the construction industry. In the 2016 election, after the 2016 election, it was mobilize young Latino voters. Well, if I looked around at the things I was possibly going to do, this was the thing that could have the greatest realm of impact. And it was totally the wrong time for me personally. I have a 3-year-old little boy. He was 2 at the time, who I was primarily at that time raising by myself. But I just went on this really long run. And I was like, you know, because that's how I process and think as I go on runs. And I thought, well, it was a really wrong time for me when I was 24 and an undergrad full time that I became the executive director of Workers Defense Project. And it was the really wrong time when I was 6 months pregnant and Trump won and I launched this organization, Jolt, and I had no money to pay for everything. And it's the really wrong time for me personally right now, but it is the right moment for someone like me to run and potentially win. And I will regret it more if I do not try. So I threw my hat in the ring and, you know, it was a very, as I said, interesting 12-way primary dogfight, but we did pick up a lot of important endorsements. AOC endorsed me in the race. Joaquin Castro endorsed me. Dolores Huerta, I guess, like the Latino trilogy. Alec Baldwin has been my friend since he discovered my work back in, like, I think 2013, and we've remained friends since then.
What was one of the more surreal moments, if there were any?
I don't know that there were, like, surreal moments. I think that, I guess the thing I learned is I wish I had trusted my gut more. Like, mm-hmm. as an organizer, I kind of tried to just be a candidate this time. And I think we came really close to making it into the runoff. And there were some also fucked up things about why we didn't make it into the runoff. Like, in the Valley, I was on page 2. There's a lot of folks, like, they had to keep scrolling. They couldn't find me. And so they would vote and then they wouldn't realize that I was actually on the second page. That happened in a lot of counties mm-hmm. where I should have been able to win.
This was also after, correct me if I'm wrong, because I believe, I don't know if the primary was delayed. Was this before
no,
or after?
No, no, no. This was, we.
The runoff was delayed.
The runoff was delayed. This was not delayed. It would have helped if it had been delayed because I picked up like AOC's and Joaquin's endorsement, like, during the early vote portion.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was like, it's tough to get out. I guess I would just say, like, I wish I had trusted my instincts more as an organizer, because I do know how to, like, build systems and structures. But I don't know that there were any really surreal moments. I think the thing I also learned, so in my campaign, like, we developed a plan of how Texas could get to net zero emissions, like a Green New Deal for Texas. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just was shocked that people were not using the space or developing plans for Texas to actually be a leader on these issues. And so for me, it taught me as like, no, I didn't make it into the runoff. And I was taking on both like the Democratic establishment of DC that backed MJ and Royce West, who I endorsed and I think is great. Yeah. But he had every single state legislator that's a Democrat except like 2 endorse him and help him.
Royce has been in the state legislature for quite a long time, done a lot of good.
almost as long as I've been alive. So, you know, he had a lot of political capital and I had like, you know, some immigrant workers and people under 30 to help me. So I think we're within striking distance of taking on both of those structures and systems as progressives. We just got to get ourselves more organized.
Do you think voters are trying to be too smart? It's not the right word. Too calculated in how they decide? Like, because I would talk to people like, who are you voting for in the primary? And they'd say MJ. I'm like, why? Because she rides a motorcycle? Because she has tattoos? It's like, well, you know, she can raise money and she can appeal to moderates. It's like, why don't we vote for the people that we find exciting and the people that interest us? Because if we see that, maybe that means they're going to excite others too when they have a bigger platform, when they become the candidate. Like, there are some people you will never reach until you win the primary. They are not interested in politics enough to where they are going to notice anybody until you win the primary. So do you think we need to shift how we decide to vote for people? Because I don't believe I met anybody that was like, I really think MJ is the right person for the job. It was all about kind of electioneering type. I think she could win.
Yeah. So one, I think that people have to realize that in a state as big as Texas, I think that we battle against two things. There's like the traditional Democratic politics side, which the machine, which is like, you need to be able to raise money and you do need to be able to raise some money. Like you cannot run on $5, but I was the candidate that raised the second most amount, given that I was taking on like the entire Democratic Senate committee. And the other thing I would say, so that's one piece, but MJ wasn't raising money because MJ was a better fundraiser. MJ was raising money because Chuck Schumer and everyone else was helping her.
But they would have helped you if you won the primary, right? Like it's like
the
primary winner is going to be able to raise money.
Exactly. And so that's the second thing. But the first thing I think I want to push back on is I think there's the mythology that in Texas you win as running as a Republican light candidate. And mostly those Republican-like candidates have often not spoken to the diversity of the state. Like Beto did well for multiple reasons. He was a good candidate. He was a great candidate. He was running against Ted Cruz, which is much easier. And Beto actually, even though he's a white guy, he really did speak to the diversity of the state. Like as a child of an immigrant, I didn't feel like he was selling out.
He didn't seem like he was pandering.
No, and he spoke to the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
The thing about Texas is if you believe that we are going to win by swinging white Republican voters, you have fucking lost already. And let me tell you why. The supermajority of the Democratic Party, the majority of the state's population is brown and black.
Yeah.
And the supermajority of the Democratic Party and anywhere you can move the needle lies mostly with communities of color. And that is where we failed. We did not have a candidate that and I don't think it requires being from one of those communities, but it requires spending time with them, investing in them. It was challenging because MJ didn't even put in the work to get Royce's endorsement, which was unfortunate. I wish he would have endorsed her as well, but like he chose not to because she didn't put in the work.
Especially with how politics shifted so dramatically after the incident in Minnesota, you know, and when race became such a prominent issue. It was just, I could spend a whole podcast ranting about MJ's campaign.
Yeah. But you have to be able to speak to the diversity of the state and the real needs we face. And then you have to put the time and energy into those communities. And that didn't happen. And if you look at the numbers in Texas, look, I believe you need a multiracial coalition to win in Texas, but you've got to drive up numbers amongst young people who mostly vote progressive, and you've got to drive up numbers amongst Latino voters. Those are the only way that Democrats are going to win in Texas. There are not enough unicorn white swing Republican voters to win. There are not.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Not going to happen. So let's talk about the Latino voter. Is it the Latino or the Latinx voter?
So I say, so there's a recent study, you know, I'm one of those people that says, like, I will call you whatever you want.
Sure.
And actually, the studies that show the term that Latinos prefer the most in Texas, I don't personally, it's not what I call myself, but is Hispanic. That's actually the majority of what Latinos in Texas want to call themselves. But you can say Latinx, Latino, Hispanic.
Well, I bring it up specifically because I think we saw the same study. And I've seen anecdotal evidence, so I don't want to say it's, I don't want to overstate it, but there's a difference, it seems, especially when you look in a place like the Rio Grande Valley. And I'm not from the Rio Grande Valley. I just have in-laws there and family friends there. A disconnect between people like yourself, who I would put in, you know, young activist, more likely to be first generation American, versus more rural families that are either immigrants or have been here for generations but aren't college educated. Basically, is it possible that rural people of color, or at least rural Hispanics in Texas, particularly the Rio Grande Valley, have more in common than rural whites than we're willing to admit as progressives in this state?
Yeah. So, you know, in Texas, like as Latinos, I'm reading this, literally this 800 page book that's called Big Wonderful Thing, The History of Texas. And it's this incredible book. And I think as Latinos, you have to remember, and I think a lot of elected officials and parties forget this, is that we are a community that many of us are newly arrived to this country. And yet we have existed in Texas before Texas in the United States was ever even imagined. And so you have to be able to speak to that duality, which we live in as a community. And in Texas, this election, I think the reporting was so bad. I was just on a call last week with someone and they said, correct me if I'm wrong, Trump won the Latino vote in Texas. And I was like, no, he didn't. And that's not that person's fault that they thought that. They thought that because the reporting was so bad and it focused on a few counties.
But he did better than he did in 2016.
Yes, he did better than he did in 2016, but that is not...
Not the same.
Not the same. So first off, just like the numbers so that people know, in Texas, according to Latino Decisions, which is who I trust the most that does the polling, because they also do a certain percentage in Spanish that actually matches the population that's monolingual Spanish speakers, and they tend to vote more for Democrats. 67% of Latinos voted for Biden in Texas in 2020. And if you look at in the metro areas, right? You're right. You're totally right, Brandon. There's an urban-rural divide, which people don't realize. So of Latinos, people talk about the Valley. People are operating on a vision of the Latino vote in Texas that's, I think, from like the 1980s, which is thinking we only live in four counties or five counties in South Texas, when actually 60% of the Latino population lives in the five major metros. And in those five major metros, anywhere, the lowest number, which was Harris County, 70 to 80% of Latinos voted for Biden. And in the RGV, 15% of the Latino population in Texas lives in the RGV. That being said, you know who won in the Democratic primary, who like crushed that vote?
Bernie?
Bernie Sanders. Yes. Bernie Sanders crushed that vote in the RGV. Mm-hmm. And what's important is that he spent money and time and spoke to the real economic issues that Latinos live every single day, especially in those rural communities. We're talking about some of the poorest counties in the entire state and almost in the country are in that region.
Do you think it has to do with the cult of personality? Bernie is a lot like Trump and I'm forgetting. Oh, the president in Mexico?
AMLO.
So Bernie is a lot like Trump and AMLO in that it's strong personality, almost populist appeal. Do you think that is a factor? Like what attracts Mexicans in the Rio Grande Valley to Bernie that then attracted them to Trump in the general?
I mean, I think people, one, again, like our community is incredibly poor. Our community works incredibly hard and there are not the jobs or investment in our community that we deserve. So if someone speaks to that economic pain, like, look, Bernie Sanders ran in 2016 on raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. He was the only candidate at that time doing that. You have to understand 60% of Latinos make under $15 an hour.
Yeah. And you wonder why we have so much issue with homelessness or poverty. And it's like, do the math on what that is in a year and ask yourself, how could you live?
Right. And so Bernie spoke to that. Now, the other thing is that Bernie spent a lot of cash on Latino voters. Like that was his pathway. He saw Latino voters and completely right. A good friend of mine, Chuck Rocha, ran his Latino outreach.
He did really well in Nevada as well because of that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. There's like Latino voters are up for grabs. That's what he saw. Latino voters are up for grabs because they're coming out in higher numbers. No one usually spends money or time talking to them. If we spend money and time talking to them and use our populist message to make sure it reaches them, they're going to come out and vote. Mm-hmm. So I think that we still have to do, I'm a data person. Like, I don't like when people start saying like, oh, we lost the election because I have this anecdotal story about my aunt or whatever. So we need to do more research and figure out how we need to speak better. But a lot of it, I think, honestly, will just come down to investment. Like, are we going to spend the time and money reaching voters, Latino voters that are in the rural areas, because this is a rural, mostly rural area, not super urban, that was underinvested in.
It seemed like one campaign that didn't underinvest in the area is the Trump campaign. I seem to remember seeing like a surprisingly amount of Spanish written voiceovers, billboards. How do you think the Trump campaign succeeded in their target of the area?
I mean, I think that they spent real cash. You also have a community. I do think, like, if you look at the voting patterns in the RGV, you do have to realize that even though it's been mostly Democratic, that there it is tends to be, because it is, again, a rural urban divide, oftentimes tends to be more conservative in how it votes, that you have a substantial number of community members that have jobs in law enforcement and in the oil and gas industry. But at the end of the day, I do think the economic issues that most Democrats at this point are standing on, which is like strong labor movement, raising the minimum wage, and taxing billionaires what they deserve. I think we need to be a little bit stronger in the message overall in the moderate wing. But that actually resonates and speaks to most people. But that you have to spend money on speaking to voters to let them understand that's the full message and platform that you stand for. Because Trump just goes around lying and spending money telling people the Democrats don't care about them and they don't hear anything else, then that could be the way they vote. But again, Trump didn't even win.
I understand.
Region in the valley, he increased his percentage.
He won additional counties in the valley, but not the biggest urban counties. Like, I don't think he didn't win Brownsville. He didn't win McAllen, but I do think he won counties that he lost in 2016. I mean, I get what you're saying. It's not like they won, though. It's just surprising because it was seemingly, we're looking at a candidate that was seemingly so unbelievably racist. So I think that's really where a lot of the attention.
I get what you're saying. I guess for me, I push back. I always try and gain perspective because I have a lot of folks that will spend time, like the amount of stories that came out about voters in South, like a percentage of voters, a minority of voters, Latino voters that voted for Trump versus the overwhelmingly majority that voted for Biden, and the entire story that's being missed about the Latino vote, not just in Texas, but the country, is we had never as a community reached where the majority of us voted. So not 50%, more than 50% of us had voted in an election as a community, even though we now make up the largest non-white voting bloc. Well, this election, 2/3 of Latino eligible voters went and voted. The vast majority voted for Democrats, and younger voters, Latinos were the youngest ethnic group. We came out in like full force this election. And so while we're focusing on this, political reporters and pundits are actually missing the tsunami of change that is coming from young Latino voters that are incredibly progressive, have been doing incredible grassroots work. Arizona didn't flip overnight. It took 10 fucking years of organizing since SB 1070. Texas hasn't had that same level of investment. And love my friends in Arizona, but Arizona is like a pueblo compared to the size of Texas.
Right, right. I totally get what you're saying. Like, we shouldn't be scapegoating, because, I mean, if half of the population in Texas would have voted for Biden, then he would have won the state.
I mean, like, let's just talk about the numbers based on gender just really quickly.
Sure.
I think the number is 87% of African-American women voted for Biden in Texas. 75% of Latinas voted for Biden in Texas.
Right.
Just 38% of white women voted for Biden in Texas. 38%.
Yeah. Where does the focus lie then going forward for the Democratic Party in Texas? Is it fall with trying to win those white voters? Does it fall with trying to organize more people who aren't registered in the Latino community? Does it fall on all the people who are moving here from out of state, making sure they're registered and they become active participants? Because it's a big state, which is great, but it also means there are so many different areas to focus on, and you can't do all of it to the extent that you need to. So how do you prioritize your strategy to maybe flip Texas blue in 2028 or 2032?
So one, I don't think it's that far off, but
you think 24 could, Texas could go blue?
I think it could go blue in 2024. And the reason I think that is because Republicans came, they're not going to have Trump. I think it's highly unlikely. I think it could go blue in 2022. I think it's highly unlikely without Trump on the ticket that Republicans will be able to do as well as they did in the state. The other thing is that the state is changing so, so fast.
Right.
And by our next governor's race, one in three eligible voters is under the age of 30. We saw Texas go from last in voter turnout and youth voter turnout in 2016 to number one in youth voter turnout. And so those numbers are going to continue to shift and grow with a state.
It'll be good for Governor McConaughey.
I will not be voting for Governor McConaughey. But
no, let's talk about that afterward, because I might. Is because, hey, let me. Look.
Oh, I mean, I think if he was running, if he was the Democratic candidate, I would vote for him.
No, yes, if it's an independent
in a primary.
Here my thing. Hey, I cannot imagine a scenario in which any Democrat is going to beat Greg Abbott, but I could see McConaughey beating him.
Sure.
So it's an issue of what's in my eyes, and tell me if I'm wrong.
McConaughey's a million times better than Greg Abbott.
Okay.
I agree. Okay. But I was, what I'm saying is,
sorry,
the state is so big.
Sure.
And it's the idea that one person or one single strategy is what flips a state is just not true. So I think that you've got to look at where the biggest margins and gains are to be made. Texas has the biggest margins and gains to be made with young voters, mostly voters of color. We forget, we talk a lot about Latino voters, but in Texas, we also have the largest Black population of any state in the country by size, mm-hmm. right? So Black and brown voters are where we need to make gains, and young voters. But with Latino voters, we need to focus on women. Like there's a clear distinction in how we vote based on gender in my community. And so we know the trends, we're just not following them. And Democrats are not investing in the infrastructure beyond an election cycle. You are not gonna win in Texas unless you go register more young voters and more voters of color. That has been historically underfunded.
Did you have difficulty with your stance on abortion? People of color who tend to be a little more Catholic, religious? That's the common thing that I've heard, especially for female candidates more than men.
Yeah, so I mean, I think what's important I'm pro-choice, right? And I've always been pro-choice. And I would talk about it about why, right? Like the values of why I was. And, you know, look, I ran an immigrant organization, and had we taken a vote, we probably would have been a pro-life organization. But I have experience talking to people that have not just of because of their faith traditions, whether they're evangelical or Catholic, that this is a deeply important issue to them. And I understand why it is. And as someone that's now had a child, like I understand that. And so I think being able to understand where people are coming from and then also explaining where we're coming from. So I would explain to people, look, I'm pro-choice because of my mother. My mom is the oldest of nine kids. There was no birth control whatsoever where she grew up. My mom grew up extremely Catholic. And after having my brother and me, doctors told her, don't have any more children. If you have any more children, you will die most likely, because she nearly bled to death with my brother. And a year later, she got pregnant by accident. And for her, it was the hardest decision, one of the hardest decisions she's ever made. She decided to have an abortion. She did not want me talking about it at first on the campaign trail. I had to like fight with her to allow me to talk about it. Look, I'm the person I am today because my mom helped raise me. And had she not been able to have an abortion, I don't know that I would be the person I am. I don't think I would have been raised by my mother. I would have been like an orphan. And so thank God she had that right. And shouldn't that be the right of every single person, every single woman? And if you talk about it that way, I would find a lot of commonality is that I think talking about it, yes, it should be the right and a protected right to healthcare for every single woman. But talking about how it is a difficult decision for some people and why it's a difficult decision, and then honoring that because it is so difficult for so many people that it needs to be their private individual decision. I don't even call it a choice. For my mom, it didn't feel like a choice. It felt like something she had to decide to do.
Right. Just be able to talk about it earnestly and be look people in the eye and be honest about your opinions and why you feel the way you feel. In my humble opinion, and I'm just a lowly podcaster, it seems for Texans, especially progressive Texans, the most important thing on deck is the ledge. And unfortunately, we did not win the state house like we were hoping. So we do not have a seat at the table for redistricting. And everybody remembers the 2012 midterms when Democrats were slaughtered, and it wasn't only because of passing Obamacare in the short term was unpopular. It was because all of the advanced algorithms that led to advanced gerrymandering. And we were able to overcome a lot of that in the last two cycles just because we were so far away from when those lines were driven. Mm-hmm. And we've seen people, because of housing shortages, move into areas that were traditionally more Republican because they can have housing. Mm-hmm. The worry is the models they're going to be using for redistricting to gerrymander are going to be even better this time. And what do we do? You know, like 20 years ago, and I think maybe even 10, I don't remember, Democrats fled to Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And it didn't do anything. We don't have power. We don't have the governorship. We don't have the lieutenant governor. We don't have the Senate. We don't have the state house. What do we do? I don't know.
I think that if we look at, we saved democracy to like live another day by defeating Trump.
Sure.
However, there were real, real losses. Like the loss you're talking about in Texas is so substantial. I feel like for me, I'm a progressive, so I do not like what the Republican Party for the most part stands for at all. And then I feel like Democrats largely have failed us, especially on economic issues. But on the issue of representation in our democracy, they've been strong for everyone in this party, you know, because of who the base of the Democratic Party is. Quite honestly, like, I feel like this is the fight we need to have in the legislature. It sucks it's going to be via Zoom, because I was preparing to organize Jolt members and other folks to go, like, you know, do civil disobedience in the Texas legislature.
Do we block them from getting in? Like, what?
I mean, I think the reality is that we're going to have to organize as best we can, given the districts and what they're going to represent. I still think we can fight during the legislature, but you're right. At the end of the day, we don't have the political numbers to be able to shift the outcome as we would like. That being said, I think that there are groups like MALDEF, Mexican American Legal Education Defense Fund, that has always played a key role in trying to make it as representative as possible. I think folks should like chip in money to them right now and make sure that they have as much resources as possible to fight. But sadly, I don't, as a progressive, I'm usually pretty hopeful and try and inspire people to remember our power. But in this one, I think that it's going to be really, really, really tough.
So I was convinced after the 2017 ledge that 2019 comes and bathroom bills galore. That didn't happen. And the reason I think, and again, I'm just a lowly podcaster, I don't really know what I'm talking about, was because of corporations, Texas corporations, that actually put pressure on Republicans. So is there any way at all we can get corporate Texas, the DFW HQs, the Houston HQs, somehow on the side of nonpartisan redistricting? Like, is there any hope there? Or
I don't know, but I think it's a good idea. I feel like, you know, from my organizing days with immigrant workers and doing stuff at the Texas legislature, that the only thing the Texas legislature cared about when it came to discriminatory policies was what business said.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, that was the only time they were willing to move, is if their donors and the businesses that they were backed by said, shift right instead of left.
Right.
And I would hope that there would be some principled folks that would be willing to take that stand. I don't know, to be honest. But I think it's a great strategy because it's the only thing they listen to.
It's the only thing they listen to. It's the only thing. I was shocked. I was so shocked. And it was just something happened behind closed doors. I don't know who it was. I don't know who it was, Shell. But, geez. Anyway, well, thank you so much for joining me. I had a really great time. You are tremendously talented. What do we have to look forward to in your future here in the great state of Texas, besides raising a young boy and having a great family?
Thanks. Well, I'm working on different projects right now. I'm still Jolt helping expand how we engage young Latino voters across Texas. And then, like, I've lived for changing Texas. People can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Christina for Texas and find out some of the projects that I'm part of and trying to do to transform the politics of the state. I would just say follow me there. And then I'm cooking up some cool projects. We're working on a film actually with two really great filmmakers, Hector Galan, that produced the series Chicano on PBS, and then Elizabeth Avian that made
Robert Rodriguez's former wife, who runs her own production company now.
Yeah, we're working on a film together called Turning Texas.
Oh, it's great.
About the shifting demographics of the state and the power of the young Latino vote that documents like our work at Jolt and Shifting Texas. So that will be out next year. So that's one of my side hustle
awesome.
Projects and a podcast and some other stuff. So.
Elizabeth is super dope. I doubt she remembers me, though. What's the name of your podcast?
It's called Three Righteous Mamas. It's actually pretty cool. It's myself. We just launched it. It's myself. There's three moms that we met after the 2016 election. I'm Latina and have a three-year-old. My friend Martha has two kids. She's queer and has two beautiful adopted kids. And my friend Muna, who's Muslim and has two kids. And so it's just us talking and interviewing really amazing folks, but also talking about the intersection of motherhood from our different identities and experiences.
Wow. That's amazing. I just have dogs. I don't know. It's like so over my head.
Well, you do so many podcasts. You don't want kids?
I want whatever my wife says she wants. And for a while it was no kids. Now she's on prenatal vitamins, so it's whatever she.
Oh wow!
Whatever she tells me.
I never wanted children until I turned 30, and then I turned 30, and I was like, "Oh my god, my eggs are dying! I need to
have a baby." I just get more dogs. I'm trying to talk her into a bulldog, but she's resistant.
Maybe.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Really enjoyed having you. So thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Okay, thanks so much. Bye.
If you like this interview, please check out our sister podcast, Wrong Side of 30 and 90 Day Soiree. Thank you.